Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. And to begin our program today, we're going to be taking a look at End of Life Matters. As a matter of fact, that is the title of a book that written by Steve Bozalaki. Steve is from Middleton, Wisconsin, author of White Coat Wisdom. And that particular book won several awards this spring, if I'm not mistaken, Steve.
Yes,
that's great.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. Congratulations on that. His new book, End of Life Matters, relies on the experiences of 11 Wisconsin physicians who've seen good and bad deaths from a great variety of vantage points. And it's an abridged version, a very abridged version of the hardcover oral history, White Coat Wisdom, is it not?
That's right. The hardcover is 590 pages and covers quite a number of healthcare issues. This one focuses primarily on end-of-life care.
And why did you choose to put this book together?
Well, this is an issue that's a rather taboo topic, as you know. And people sometimes are really kind of spooked about even talking about death. But now that health reform is so hot with the new president, I don't think you can even consider health reform without thinking about how we die in this country. Something like 90% of healthcare costs are incurred in the last 6 weeks of life. Now, if you think about that, it's really incredible. We're doing something wrong, and we're spending a lot of money at the end of life, and are we really getting good quality healthcare at the end of life? And I think the answer is no.
Although doctors, the doctors in your book, they do as good as they can, but there's so many issues even for them.
Well, that's right. I think part of the problem rests with doctors. They're trained to save lives and not help people necessarily end their life in the best way possible. And I think some physicians see death as a failure on their part. And of course, as a patient, you want your doctor to do everything he or she to keep you going and be healthy. But we've seen so many examples. The most glaring one was last December, where Sunny von Bülow passed away finally after 30 years. Well, she spent almost 30 years in an unconscious state at the cost of something like $500,000 a year. Now, was that really a good use of healthcare dollars?
Yeah.
I say no, and we don't have to end our lives that way.
Well, your book not only talks about dying, it covers other things, organ donations, pain medicines,
exactly.
Healthcare.
There's so much to the end-of-life process, and these physicians, educate the public by talking about these various issues in anecdote forms. Like Dr. Tina Sauerhammer, for instance, is a physician at University Hospital, and she lost her father because he couldn't get a kidney. He was on a waiting list for a kidney, and he died at a very young age, about 45. So she talks about the necessity of people signing those organ donor cards instead of, just letting that go and not wanting to discuss it. If you fill out your power of attorney for healthcare form, there's a box you can check, and you can let your family and everyone else know that, yes, if I pass away, I would like my organs to go and help another person. You can potentially save the lives of something like 50 people. It's really amazing, but lots of us don't want to think about it, and we don't make that choice.
Steve Bozalaki, our guest today, author of End of Life Matters. It's published by Apollo's Voice. I'm talking with him, obviously, about those End of Life Matters, and also organ donation, pain medicines, healthcare decision-making, faith in healing, the medical cost. Boy, there's a lot here in the book. And you can join in, weigh in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Give us a call, shoot us an email. We'd be glad to get you on the air. And let's go to Gail in Madison, who has a question or comment. Gail, hi.
Hi. I may have misheard, but I thought Steve just said that 90% of health care costs occurred in the last 6 weeks of life.
That's right.
And that, where does that number come from?
Well, one of the physicians that I interviewed was Dr. John Whitcomb from the Milwaukee area. He's an ER physician, and he he looks into this stuff, and that was what he told me. And even if the number is 12 weeks, it's an incredible amount of money that is spent, you know, in the remaining months and weeks of people's lives.
I'm just thinking that a certain percentage of people die more or less, and therefore, if you take, let's say, 20% of people have the sort of 6 weeks are spent in high cost areas. That leaves 80% of the people who have less intense deaths, and I just find that statistic totally bogus. Saying that somebody else said that was his experience.
Well, you know, there are things in healthcare that are
recognize that it can be a lot, but I think by exaggerating, we just shoot this cause in the foot.
Well, look into it yourself if you don't believe it. There are certain things in healthcare that are just shocking. Take smoking, for instance. If 18 jumbo jets crashed every day in America, the Congress would be up in arms, and we would find a way to figure out why this is happening. Yet that is the number of people who are dying from smoking-related illness in this country every day. It seems, as you said, totally bogus. It seems too astronomical to be true, yet it's true. That's how some of these issues in healthcare are. We don't put them in perspective. We don't really understand the severity of the problem. And end-of-life care is in that category. We're spending a lot of money at the end of life.
I would agree we're spending a lot. I still have great difficulty believing that 90% of all healthcare dollars are spent within 6 weeks of a person's death. But I guess we're not going to solve that one right now.
All right. Thanks, Gail. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call and your comment. Well, the number has got to be very high, you know, because that's where, you know, I look at myself now. Over the years, I've had very little. I mean, I go to the doctor once, twice a year, and I've had my appendix out. I had some surgery on my hand earlier this year. So my expenses are close to very, very low, let's put it that way.
Exactly. Well, ICU care is very expensive, getting an ambulance. And then if you're on a respirator or if you need a transplant, all kinds of things can cost an inordinate amount of money.
Well, let's take some more callers here. Don in Janesville. We'll go to you now. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just started listening to the program, but one thing it's always perplexed me a little bit in our culture is that, well, first of all, the fact that you term the end-of-life process to me is might be jumping the gun a little bit, because I personally think that it's not an end. We see it as the end, but it could, you know, I think it could not be the end.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of my comment goes right with that, and that is, I've always been perplexed by our ritual of pumping the dead body with toxic preservatives, and then putting it not only in a pine box or whatever, now I suppose you could get fiberglass and whatever else box that you put the body in, which then goes into a concrete box, which to me seems like we've almost removed ourselves from the cycle of nature. I just wondered if you had any comments on that.
Sometimes I wonder about that, too. You think there's only so much space on the Earth, and eventually, if we keep on doing what we're doing, we would fill up the entire Earth with cemeteries. But, you know, that's a personal choice for families, how they want to, you know, deal with the death of a loved one. But it does make you wonder. There's a great book called Stiff, STIFF, by Mary Roach, and she talks about how we deal with dead bodies, and it's a fascinating read, and she does talk about the environmental aspects of cremation and burying people, and take a look at that one. You might find it really interesting.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Don. Appreciate it. Adam in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. You're always in such a good mood. I'm impressed by how you can always be so happy. And my comment is that I see so many people that are interested in going into the medical industry now that the economy is bad because they see it as a reliable career with really good wages for the most part. And I think that I never hear people criticize the medical industry in terms of the salaries that are made by doctors, nurses, surgeons, and people like pharmacists, the drug companies themselves. And there's so much money that's being made by these people, and we hear people always complaining about the cost of medical care, but we never hear people complain about the salaries of the people that are in the industry because they're very much related. So I want to know why you think that we never hear about that relationship, and if you think that some of the people are possibly overpaid in the medical industry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think certainly some physicians earn way more money than others. For instance, certain specialists in surgery can make astronomical amounts of money, while a family medicine physician or a pediatrician will not earn nearly as much. And I think part of getting it back to the end-of-life issue is we need to have more physicians who are interested in hospice care and primary care who can help coordinate the person at the end of his or her life so you're making smart decisions. A perfect example, all the way up to the President of the United States, his grandmother recently passed away, and she had terminal cancer and ended up having hip replacement surgery several weeks before she died.
No.
Now, was that really the best route for her? And I highly doubt that a hospice person was involved or a palliative care expert. And that's what happens in our country, that you know we're presented with these very difficult situations. And of course, the president wants to do the best that he can for his grandmother. Mm-hmm. But I wonder whether she really got the best care. It was expensive mm-hmm. care, but her quality of life probably didn't improve very much. And she passed away shortly thereafter.
Yeah. Well, I would think that, hip replacement surgery a few weeks before you die, you'd have a lot of pain from that.
Exactly.
I would assume. Well, interesting comment, though, Eden. I thank you very much for calling. You know, insurance is the other issue here, too. I've talked to physicians who are making quite a bit less money than they made 10 years ago, 15 years ago, primarily because of insurance issues. So.
Right. But physician salaries are actually a very small part of the whole healthcare cost issues. Their salaries have not gone up very much, especially in recent years.
Let's go to Nikki in Madison next. Nikki, hi.
Hi, it's Nikki. But I wondered, at what age are you too old to donate organs?
Oh, that's a good question. Most people can donate throughout their life. And once you get past the age of 80, it's very limited. But I think even an 80-year-old person, there are certain parts that can be useful to others, parts of bone, that sort of thing.
Oh.
So okay. Everyone should really look into it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And I was thinking back to my own surgery where I had this tumor removed from a bone in my finger, and there was some bone marrow from a cadaver that was inserted into my finger. So,
and isn't it wonderful that family was willing to donate and improve your – I mean, it's got to be a good feeling for the
yes.
family to know that they helped someone else with that donation.
Let's take some more calls here, and Amelia – I believe up next in Stoughton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to address the woman who was astounded at the statistic when you first started out.
Oh, the end-of-life cost?
Yeah, and then I also want to address the gentleman who thought that healthcare salaries were high. The first caller who didn't believe the statistic, that's actually, I'm a nurse. That statistic is well known in the healthcare community. That's an old statistic and a true one. So she should rest assured that that's well known and well documented. And the second comment about the salaries, I would just say that if that gentleman would like to come and work the 12-hour shift of a nurse in the trenches or take work a shift of a family practice physician who does office hours all day and then takes the beeper after hours and comes and admits patients into the hospital till all hours of the night, then he would see that we actually earn those wages. So I just wanted to, you know, let people know that if they think those salaries are high, then what they need to do is put themselves in our shoes. We work very, very hard doing things that I hear patient families say, oh, I could never, ever do what you're doing.
Yeah.
So people really need to think about that. We do things that people really don't want to do.
Yeah.
We're doing nitty-gritty stuff and very, you know, I mean, if you're talking hospice or you're talking the emergency room or even on a medical surgical floor, you know, we're right there working with patients with very, you know, very intimate settings.
You know, one of the reasons I wanted to write White Coat Wisdom was because of some of what this caller is talking about. I just think of myself like, can you imagine having the responsibility for someone's life? Larry, you and I, if we make a mistake, people aren't going to fall over and die.
Right.
But if these people don't do something right, they could actually cause the death of someone or fail to prevent a death by doing the right thing. There's so much responsibility put on their backs. So personally, I don't have a whole lot of trouble paying the best and brightest in our society to handle the lives of human beings.
Yeah.
But that said, I should also say that it's also a great honor to do what we do.
Yeah. And that certainly is echoed in Steve's book. Amelia, thank you so much for calling. I hear that in the words of the doctors that you interviewed throughout the book.
Yeah, they love what they do. I was almost jealous after like hearing these stories. It was 56 hours of interviews that I did to come up with these books, and that just kept coming through their love for what they were doing. They got so much satisfaction out of helping people, and they didn't see what they do as a job per se. They really saw it as a calling. And I thought that's a good way to look at a profession. If you know you're doing something for other people because you want to do it. It's not because of the paycheck. It's because you want to help people.
Again, Amelia, thank you so much. Steve Bozalaki, our guest today, author of End of Life Matters. It's published by Apollo's Voice. He's also the author of White Coat Wisdom, won 3 national literary awards this spring with White Coat Wisdom, as a matter of fact. Really pleased to have him with us today. If you want to join in with your questions as we talk about these End of Life Matters, join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dealing with End of Life Matters today with Steve Bozalaki, author of the book End of Life Matters and also the book White Coat Wisdom. Pleased to have him along. And Sherry in Madison is up next with a question or comment. So let's go there. Sherry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. A couple of comments. My first one is about that whole 6-week, you know, end of life cost thing. You don't know that they're the last 6 weeks lots of times. So, you know, that statistic can be a little bit confusing. You know, sometimes you incur tremendous costs trying to keep someone alive, and unfortunately they die, but at the time you didn't know they were the last 6 weeks of life. So that's just a little comment. But
sure.
As far as end of life care, we do really need to talk about this type of thing a lot, and I wish it would start with the primary physicians in the office when the person is not in like a crisis situation, so that really, you know, you have it on record if they do want to be do not resuscitate, if they don't want to be intubated, because oftentimes in the heat of the moment it's hard to make these decisions, and the best care doesn't always equate with the most care. And I think sometimes family members for their loved ones, you know, they don't want to say anything less than let's do everything we can without really knowing what that really means in the healthcare world today. So Those are my comments.
All right. Thanks very much. Those good comments. Steve, a comment from you.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's one of these situations where we want good quality at the end of our life, and we don't know exactly when the end will be. Doctors don't know. They can say, well, the statistics show us you're likely to have 6 weeks to 3 months. Well, you could die in a week, or you might die in a year, or you might beat it completely. There's really no way to know. All I'm suggesting here is at the end of life, when people are terminally ill, we're spending a whole lot of money, and are we really, you know, making the patient's experience better? I can think of my own experience with my father, who passed away at age 88. Luckily, he did fill out the power of attorney for healthcare. We knew exactly what he thought about these things. And all I could think about while we were going through this is, who can I call? Who can save my dad? I know all these doctors that I've interviewed. And then I just had to listen to the physician, the intensivist. I had never even heard of that specialty before, but they're the people who deal with people who are critically ill in a hospital. And he just said, look, your dad has extensive heart disease. Even if his vital signs were to come back, a surgeon wouldn't even do the surgery because it'd be unlikely for him to survive the surgery. So then I said, well, what are we doing here? We've got all these tubes connected to him. He's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, that's a very good question. He said, normally we do this just to gather the family. I said, well, the family's here. And at that point, we took all the stuff off, and my dad had a very peaceful death. But it's a hard thing to accept when it's your loved one. But I think it was the best route to go.
And in your book, several of the doctors talk about their own parents and mothers and so forth. I remember one in particular talking about his own mother, Dr. Schwartzstein.
Yes, Dr. Schwartzstein. Oh, boy, does he tell a story. And his mother had a bowel obstruction, and the whole issue was, should we treat this? A surgeon said, I really think I can help your mom. But the mother, the patient herself, really didn't want to go through surgery so late in life. And ultimately, they followed her wishes. She did not want to have surgery, and she did pass away. But the lesson from the Alan Schwartzstein story is that you have to stand up to your doctor sometimes. Even when they want to do something, they're rare to go, they think they can help. It is the patient's choice. It's the patient's choice as to what is going to be done. And that's why it's so important to fill out the power of attorney for healthcare. Whatever you think about end-of-life care, make it known. You know, if you want absolutely everything, well, go ahead. Write that out so there's no mystery. What happens to people like Dr. Wickham in the ER is that nothing is written. They're presented with a case. And then they just ultimately do everything
they can.
Yeah, everything, whether that person really would want that level of treatment or not.
And, you know, you mentioned to me before the show today that on your website, you actually have the form for Power of Attorney Healthcare. We should, you know, I wanted to mention that for people.
Yeah, anyone, it's a free form. Just go to whitecoatwisdom.com. Scroll down on the left side of the page. You'll see the book, End of Life Matters. And then there's a link. It says, a power of attorney for healthcare. Click the link. That'll take you to the state of Wisconsin's website, and you can just download the form. It's easy to fill out. There are just a few questions. And one of the first things it says on the form is, you have the right to make decisions about your healthcare. No healthcare may be given to you over your objection, and necessary healthcare may not be stopped or withheld if you object. So this is all on you. Let your family know. I'll tell you, for my family, you're going through a very difficult thing with a dying parent. It was a gift for my dad to have that all written out and let us know. Then we didn't have to have a big family fight over how to proceed.
Yeah, and so that's at whitecoatwisdom.com?
That's correct.
All right, let's go to Dolores in Kenosha next. Dolores, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Oh, I've been listening. This has been wonderful. I appreciate the last two callers. And your guest, I'm going to have to find his book. I am a nurse. I've been a nurse for 30 years, and I worked 10 years before that in the hospital, mainly in med-surg, and now I'm a supervisor, so I see all of it. My mother died a little over 2 weeks ago. Important thing that people need to do, the paperwork is great, but when you go into the hospital, unless you get a written order by a physician, the do not resuscitate order, you have to have that order. That's what we've got. So what you have to do is you have to talk ahead of time. Just going through the funeral preparations. Now, my mother, when she died, she She was 85. She had chronic heart disease. She also had Alzheimer's. And fortunately, before she got to a point where what she said, you know, it carried definite weight with us, which was helpful. But you must talk to everyone. You must let everyone know how you feel.
And I've heard that from doctors as well. They're saying that, you know, even if they have it written out, sometimes the person, the family member, never really discussed it. And that's so important, just to have that conversation so you can cement that in their brain that, no, you really meant what you wrote down.
And I have seen situations where family members have said, no, please, we want everything done.
Yeah.
I have seen heart surgery done on that basis. And to be honest with you, there are times when we stand next to each other and say, well, we did our job, but we're going to go to hell for this.
I got to ask you, if they have it written, how then do you override that patient's written request because of the family member? That does happen, huh?
The rules are written, that we, as we understand it, we need a physician order. And we have very hardcore nurses who will go in there and say, look, please. But if people don't talk about this ahead of time, you can get into a great big ugly situation where the family is arguing and people don't, you know, they don't know what's going on. And
Sad.
And you don't have the luxury of, well, let's all go sit down and talk about this.
Yeah,
right.
Not in
not
the
time.
Emergency room.
No, right. Not in the emergency room.
Or critical care, for that matter. So the
suggestion is that when there's a death in the family, it's a good excuse to talk about, well, Aunt Sally passed away like this. I don't want to die like that. Or yes, this is a good way to go. So I think people should look for excuses to talk about it after there's a death in the family.
Oh, yes. And God bless hospice.
Yeah.
Exactly. Wisconsin is blessed that we have a great hospice care system, and I think we need to utilize it more often.
Those people are saints. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dolores, for calling. Sandy emailed us from Fountain City and has just a comment regarding organ donation. She says, I've donated my body to science, so therefore I'm not allowed to donate my organs. Kind of torn with this because you would want to save someone's life, but I do believe donating your body to science is also very important for the future of medicine and medical students. And perhaps your guest would comment on these two types of donation. Steve?
I think they're both equally generous. There is no way somebody can learn about the human body unless he or she actually has a chance to look inside. They do everything to these cadavers to learn about the human body, and that's how we develop great physicians. So I think your contribution is every bit as important as someone who gives an organ that can save somebody's life in a different way. In a way, you could be saving many, many lives because you're going to be educating someone who can use that knowledge and work on thousands of lives throughout his or her career.
That's exactly right. Thank you for that email. Jim in Wausau, we turn to you now. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to join your very first caller who questioned one of the statistics used to open the program, that 90% of costs are incurred in the last 6 weeks of life. I don't doubt that that's a high figure. I've heard something like 60 or 70% in the last 6 months, but that seems extraordinarily high. And the statistic that your guest quoted in responding to that first caller even seems questionable. Something like 18 jumbo jets crashing every day is the equivalent of smoking's effect on our health.
Yeah, I know. Look it up. It's the Centers for Disease Control will tell you how many people are dying, and it's that many. It's astronomical.
Well,
smoking
now,
is
let's
pervasive.
Try working this out. If there are 300 people on each jumbo jet times 18, that's 5,400 per day. Multiply times 365, and you get almost 2 million people per year. Now, the population of the U.S. is 300 million. Figure that 1.5% of them die every year, that's 4.5 million. Are you telling me that smoking causes nearly half of all deaths in the United States?
I don't know if it's nearly half, but it's an incredible amount. Something like 20% of us are smokers, and it wreaks an incredible toll on the population.
So 20% of the population smoked, you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah, and that has decreased, thankfully. Yeah. It used to be higher.
Yeah. So there are, I mean, we can argue about it. The fact remains that whether you want to say 6 months or 6 weeks, the last six weeks, a huge amount of the cost of medical care comes in that last period of a person's life. There's no arguing about that. And in fact, the nurse who called earlier said the 6 weeks was, in fact, a number that she has seen many times and is generally understood in the medical community to be 6 weeks. So there we have it. Jim, I thank you for calling. Let's go to Reed in Clintonville next. Reed, pleasure to have you on board. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning, and thanks for the opportunity. Say, I'd just like to respond to the gentleman who questioned the fact that physicians and all medical personnel, for that matter, are overpaid, in that, you know, it's the same sort of argument that's made about teachers being overpaid. There's no cost that's black and white. Certainly some physicians perhaps are overpaid, and I think there are some that our family physician, for instance, here in Clintonville, I'm sure is underpaid for the work that she does. It's an enormous task. So I just wanted to make that clear that we oftentimes see things in black and white, and having been a former teacher, I suffered with that same concept, you know, for many years, that people said, oh, you're overpaid, but they don't look at all of the hidden costs that cost a district or a hospital. And certainly there are people that gouge the system on both sides. Yeah. But I think I'm very happy and very thankful for the quality medical care that I've had from our family physician, and certainly she deserves every bit of money that she earns. Also, I would say that both physicians or any medical personnel, I'm sure, you know, they have to go back to school, as teachers do, and we incur great costs going back to school to stay current. And medical personnel leaving school leave with huge debts, and so do many teachers. When I was at university, students would tell me that they would be leaving school and they'd have $30,000 worth of school loans. Medical personnel, much higher. But, I mean, those loans are a tremendous burden for young people. No matter what profession, you know, coming out into the world and trying to find a job, especially in these economic times.
Yeah.
So rather than malign people, let's try to help them and be supportive of them in all professions and help one another to succeed.
It's interesting that he's an educator, because that's what physicians are. They're really teachers, and that education bent came through in the interviews all the time. Some of them were former teachers. Many of them had parents who were teachers. They were influenced by a teacher. And they have to translate science information to lay people all the time. So they have to be good teachers to be good physicians.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for that call, Reed. I appreciate it. And I want to give Bruce and Pewaukee a chance, too. Bruce, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. As you got into this research, I'm wondering if you got into at all or touched on this national health care issue. If we have an enormous cost at the end of our lives, whatever that number is, without getting into that argument, if we have this huge cost at the end of our lives and we have national health care, does that mean that at some point in time, because as these costs continue to escalate, the government starts to ration out or dictate who lives and who dies? And I'm curious as to whether or not you touched on that in your research, and also what do they do in Canada or in Europe where they do have national health care systems?
Well, actually, we do touch on rationing, because we ration health care right now in this country. If you don't have a good health plan, you don't get health care, or you have to take Badger Care or some other government form. There are limits to what you get. If you are a university employee, there are certain limits. You can't have everything. We ration health care right now. What the doctors talk about in the book is having a smarter health care policy where everybody is covered by health care, so you catch problems earlier on, so it's not so costly and it's not so difficult to treat those particular problems. I don't know that anyone has the answer as to how we're going to fix this, but I think the first thing we have to do is be smarter, that we're just spending so much mm-hmm. on technology, and I don't think we're doing enough on the prevention side.
And Steve, let's go back to your book again and just describe, well, at first, White Coat Wisdom. If you haven't read White Coat Wisdom, that is your opus, kind of. And yeah. Explain that book.
Sure. It's an oral history, meaning that it's edited conversations on a variety of healthcare issues by some of the more incredible physicians I've come to know in my journalism career. I used to work here at Wisconsin Public Radio as the medical reporter, and that's where I started meeting a lot of these doctors. And then I met even more through the Wisconsin Medical Society, and I knew these people had stories to tell. And that was my idea, to get them to explain to us what they've seen. And each chapter is a different focus. One chapter is about end-of-life care. Actually, several chapters are about end-of-life care. Another is about men's health, how men are very, very poor about going to the doctor, and hence they die earlier than they need to just because they are not doing the preventive checks that they need to do. So there are all kinds of medical topics that are handled in the book in story form.
And then End of Life Matters, you've taken one aspect from the book and
focused on that, right? Something that's really easy to digest. The book is only about 74 pages long, and 11 physicians talk about pain control, hospice care, spirituality. That's an interesting mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. I never expected scientists to really talk about mm-hmm. spirituality so much, but these physicians kept bringing it up because there were circumstances mm-hmm. where someone survived and they had no idea why. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it. They would say something else was at work here. And I thought that was a sort of an interesting comment that they, even though these are very smart, accomplished people, they knew that they don't control everything. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things just happen.
Well, your books are available pretty much anywhere. You can order online. So your website, might as well go to your website. That's another possibility at
whitecoatwisdom.com. And then here in the Madison area, at the Meritor Hospital, Hospice is carrying it, Meritor, UW Hospital, mm-hmm. UW Bookstore, Borders, Barnes & Noble. So it's available.
Steve, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Larry, it's been fun. Thank you.
Steve Bozalaki, author of two books, White Coat Wisdom and End of Life Matters. And I found them fascinating reads, and you may as well. It was a pleasure to have him with us, and he'll probably be back at some point or another to talk again with us. We're going to switch gears quite a bit next here and talk about, you know, this coming weekend, 4th of July weekend. I'm sure I will be out, our family will be out in our boat doing some things. You may be doing some boating yourself. I know there's going to be tens of thousands probably of people out there boating. And boating safety issues come to the fore on a weekend like this coming up. Todd Schaller is Recreation Enforcement and Safety Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our guest, coming up next to talk boating safety here in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.